in Germany, one sees either the work of people like Immanuel Kant, who talk about overcoming of internal growth in his Critique of Pure Reason, but more dramatically, one sees it in the principle, the concept of enlightened absolutism, particularly in the reigns of Frederick the Great and Joseph II of Austria. Frederick the Great would argue over the course of his reign as a good enlightened monarch, friend of Voltaire, composed, he was the Enlightenment man, composed Flute Concerti, which one can still hear on the radio, corresponded with all the leading intellectuals of the period, invited Voltaire to Sanssouci. It was a disastrous sojourn for Voltaire. But nonetheless, he was determined to be an enlightened monarch. Frederick the Great would argue for the state as a rational abstraction. It wasn't simply loyalty to the Hohenzollern dynasty, but rather to this notion of the state. Louis XIV, in a famous statement attributed to him, had said, "L'état c'est moi," I am the state. Frederick the Great, writing a century later, would be famous for the statement, "Ich bin der erste Diener des Staates," I am the first servant of the state. The implication that the state is actually is exalted even above the person of the monarch and could be justified rationally. It was an attempt to redefine the basis of legitimacy for monarchy, from divine right to reason. The Enlightenment would also be an attack on traditional social privileges, against unearned privilege in particular. Why did the aristocrats enjoy tax-exempt status? Why is that? How can that be justified? How can we justify serfdom, not on moral grounds, but on rational ones, on the grounds of efficiency? Is this the most rational way to organize the economy and society? If it's irrational, many Enlightenment thinkers would also argue, it was immoral. The two were linked. So one sees in Enlightenment thought an espousal of careers open to talent. Why are these privileges of special positions for aristocracy in the army and the civil service and so on? And they also, one sees over and over again in Enlightenment thought, whether it's in Germany, whether it's in France or in England, is for the codification of law. You think, codification of law, why is this such a radical principle? And it certainly was seen as radical at the time. Well, it was radical because if you write it down, you write down the laws and imply that these laws are applicable to everyone, then aristocracy can't have special access to the law. It's not a matter of tradition. When you start codifying law and you discover all sorts of practices, legal privileges and so on that are based on nothing more than tradition, because that's the way it's always been, then you begin to get what we would now think of as legal reformers, legal scholars begin to say, well, all right, let's rationalize this. So one of the most radical things that Frederick the Great in Prussia did was to begin what was the Prussian Legal Code, seen as a radical step for a monarch indeed. Finally, in the same regard, rights were based on the notion that if there were natural laws, there were also natural rights, and that what government should be doing, what the state should be doing, was to ensure that those natural rights were protected and asserted. In economic terms, the Enlightenment also posed an assault on traditional economic life, attacking guilds, attacking internal tolls and tariffs, which crippled the European economy, attacked dues, services, and so on. Certainly, Enlightenment writers attacked the institution of serfdom for the reasons that we've just indicated. Adam Smith, of course, writing in Wealth of Nations in 1776, would, like Newton in terms of physics earlier, Adam Smith would really crystallize all of these ideas in his Wealth of Nations, in which he argued that there were natural laws of economics. He began talking about the market. This was the invisible hand. That there was a rationality of this market, and the job of government was to get out of the way and to allow these natural laws of the market to operate. He was internationalist. He was certainly against government intervention. And he made the argument, which would be quite convenient for economic liberals a generation or so later, that each of us, by pursuing our own selfish economic interests, magically, synergistically, contribute to the good of the whole. That this is how, this was the invisible hand that would guide us and the market. Well, this was an attack on the way guilds were operated. It was an attack on the system of internal tolls and tariffs, which were irrational, he argued. And all this needed to be changed. Let me conclude. This multi-pronged attack was most vehemently and consistently carried out in France after 1715. As I said, it was present, these ideas were present everywhere, but it's in France that they come to occupy center stage with real revolutionary and explosive potential. One of the reasons for this was the position of this group that was referred to as the philosophes. This doesn't mean philosophers quite literally. It means people who were interested in ideas, who were social critics involved in the exchange of ideas. They enjoyed a broad social base. They spoke to the ambiguous position of the middle classes in France, who were economically strong, but politically and socially weak. And finally, in France, the French monarchy was less responsive to change than others. Whereas even in a backward, economically backward, and in many ways politically repressive state like Prussia, or even in Habsburg Austria under Joseph II, principles of enlightened absolutism had appeared. The French monarchy continued to remain entrenched in notions of divine right monarchy and seemed remarkably unresponsive to the demands for change. The implications of that we'll see with explosive results in the outbreak of revolution in 1789.